Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio. Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week, we bring you the best news, views, and interviews with the CEOs, leaders, clinicians, founders, journalists, investors that are changing the face of healthcare in the UK and beyond. As regular listeners know, I am a CEO and co-founder of a health tech venture myself, which is called PocDoc. That's P-O-C-D-O-C. Our flagship product, which is called the Healthy Heart Check, replicates the NHS Health Check in 9 minutes using our app and one of our rapid test kits. It's available on the high street in all of the major retailers, and also we are scaling out through the NHS, so it may very well be available in your area, so please do ask. And if you'd like to know more information, please go to pocdoc.co. That's P-O-C-D-O-C.co. Thank you as ever to PocDoc for supporting the show. Thank you, as I always say at the top of the show, thank you so much to the amazing UK Health Radio for the live platform. Johan, Rafaela and the team do an incredible job. There are tons of other fantastic presenters on the show. Also, a previous Health Tech Hour guest, Nora Cavani, has just started her own show on here, which I'd like to potentially take a minor bit of credit for, if everyone would let me. But that's a great sign that actually this station is growing and full of really vibrant content, because she's awesome. I'd also like to say thank you to everyone who's listening on demand on your podcast channel of choice. We now get downloads in over 50 countries every month, which blows my mind. So thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you so much for listening and rating it and commenting. Remember to subscribe. Remember to rate the show. It really makes a difference to visibility on those podcast channels. And thank you if you are watching this on YouTube or on my Instagram channel, where we slice and dice the best clips and put them out. So that's at Steve Roost. So anyway, general all round, thank you for being here. We wouldn't be here without you. This week's show takes us back to the very front line of healthcare in the UK. It couldn't really be more front line, to be honest. And if you look at the arc of media discussions, political discussions around the NHS over the last 5 to 7 years, probably, the GP surgery is really at the heart of those discussions. Yes, there are other topics, but not quite as compelling or headline grabbing, shall we say, as some of the stuff that's been going on in the GP surgery. And actually, the GP surgery is the front door of care for pretty much everybody in the UK. So it's with great pleasure that I have onto today's show one of the UK's leading GPs, Dr. Amar Ahmed. And Amar is actually, as well as being a GP partner in the Wilmslow Health Centre in Cheshire, which is widely regarded as one of the most technologically advanced GP surgeries in the UK, he is actually somewhat of a health tech expert and a real strong voice, I would say, in the community around how to integrate technology into the NHS to improve the NHS without sacrificing clinical standards, without sacrificing patient safety, without sacrificing clinician experience or sort of clinician satisfaction or sort of happiness, so to speak. And Amar is also a regular visitor to Number 10. He's spoken at the UN around health tech and how to leverage health technology in primary care. And it's wonderful to have him on the show. Amar, how are you? Welcome to the show.
Hi, Steve. Thanks so much for inviting me. It's great to be on the show. A big fan. Great. And also, I've seen your products just next door. They're doing really well.
Great, thank you very much. Good to see. Well, we can jump into that in a second. I
Yep.
think as we're a broad church, I always like to try and set the scene a little bit, right? Because there are different things called different things, and I always try and like base everything at the top of the show. How would you describe the role of a GP surgery in today's healthcare landscape? What do you think it is, and what do you think it should be?
Yeah, so primary care in the NHS today is the front door. It is the front line. I know that they're trying to roll out more front doors in the NHS, but the long and the short of it, we are the coal face, patient-facing door under intense pressure. I'll give you an idea of the kind of work load that we're facing. The average GP now has 2,273 patients that they are responsible for, that for providing the care.
Do you mean each GP at a
Each
surgery has
full-time
two
GP,
thousand?
absolutely. So
Okay.
our practice is about 16,700 patients, but each GP is full-time, whole-time equivalent is responsible for about 2,273 patients,
Wow.
and you do all of that on a budget of roughly £120 per year. For
Per patient.
unlimited, exactly, per patient. And that's for unlimited everything, home visits, visit as many times as you want, lighting, heating, all the staff, all of that, all within that, which is much less than I think it would cost to insure a dog these days. So
I don't have a dog, so I don't know, but I think the point still stands.
the point is, we're under immense pressure. It's a pressure cooker environment, and
How many people walk through the front door, give or take, of either your surgery or any surgery or all surgeries in the UK? Like, what are we talking about here? Per week, per month?
So in 2023, for instance, we delivered 84,000 appointments. 80% of those were face to face.
How
And
many
then
days a year were you open?
all days apart from bank holidays.
Okay, so 84,000 divided by, call it 360. Wow, that's 230 a day. Is that roughly right?
That's just the appointment side, because you're also dealing with the asynchronous appointments as well, from
Wow.
letters coming in and all sorts of stuff like that. So that's the kind of pressure that we're under. Those figures are going higher and higher. I think the estimate was that we see a third of the population every month.
Is that right?
So it's
Was it, I mean, was it always, how you've been GPing for age 24 years, I think I read in my show notes, 24 years, is that
I'm in
right?
my 25th year as a partner. Joined the NHS in 1996, so coming up to 29 years there. So has it always been like this?
Yeah.
No. I mean, the NHS was founded, obviously, in 1948 in a different era.
Yeah.
And the contract then, it's been reviewed a few times, but it's essentially the same. A GP has to do what a GP has to do, unlimited appointments, unlimited, no cap on your activity. The trouble is that medicine has progressed, and before you used to have bottle of morphine and maybe a few other tablets in your armory. Now we've
Okay.
got the armory, the treatments available to us are huge. We've got diagnostics, we've got X-rays, we've got ultrasound, MRIs. So there's a lot more that we can do. So people come a lot more as well. And do remember, free at the point of delivery healthcare service in the UK.
Yeah.
Something that we all need to kind of discuss honestly as a nation. But that also, there is no limit to demand. I'm a firm believer. I've termed it Ahmed's Law. Ahmed's Law states that in a free at the point of delivery healthcare service, demand is essentially unlimited. And this is
Yeah.
something that sometimes the policymakers
Well,
and
why would it
politicians.
be? It would. Well, it's interesting. So I love shows like this, by the way, because I can already tell this is going to be one of those shows where we bounce around a little bit. So I was speaking to a friend of, so we're as Poc Doc, obviously we're looking at the US for no surprise. And I was speaking to one of our advisors over there, and they have a weird inversion, which is, because you can, but people are so willing to buy off-the-shelf medicines and sort of self-serve because they're trying to stay out of the insurance system because it's so expensive, which is like the weird inversion of what you're just talking about, right?
But there is a balance to be had. It doesn't have to be like America. There are lots of other countries around the world where they've got the balance right, but
What do you think? What give us an example? What are some of the ones where you
I'd say
think that?
some of the European countries where there is a co-payment made that kind of just makes you think again, do you really need to use this appointment? Because this is the key, and I think a lot of people need to understand this. Most people are reasonable. Most of the policymakers are reasonable. Even the MPs actually are very reasonable. What they can't get their heads around, they can't understand, is that there is a growing minority of the population that behaves unreasonably. And they are kind of bringing the system to its knees. There's other things as well, chronic underfunding that also hasn't helped.
That
But
has definitely.
you have to think about on a Monday morning, my surgery, we get about 400 requests in the morning for an
For
appointment.
appointments.
Yeah, that's one surgery, 400 requests. A lot of them are quite reasonable, and some of them aren't, but they kind of tie up your resources. And, do we as a nation have to look at, putting more responsibility on the end users and perhaps talking about user obligations and responsibilities, as well as making sure that the core contract for the NHS is properly funded? Because I think, both of those things need to be addressed, really.
I agree. And I mean, the thing I find about this, again, I'm not a GP, and I think at the grand old age that I am now, I think we can wave goodbye to any possibility of me ever being a GP.
Never
But yeah, I mean, you never say never,
know.
but
No.
I think that ship might have sailed. But these issues, correct me if I'm wrong, they're not new, are they?
No,
They're
no.
not, they've been known, right?
They've been known about since the inception of the NHS, but you're not allowed to really talk about them because if any party brings it up publicly, they know that they will lose the next election because in the UK, the NHS is the closest thing that we've got to a religion.
It's the closest thing we've got to a singular united sort of religion, right?
Yeah,
Like
exactly.
a national, a national, like I guess it's almost like our constitution, right? It's like the one thing that we all unite around.
Which is good, and we should all be really proud of the NHS, and all of the values are great, but we do need to have an honest debate and an honest discussion about how we fund it, because the way it's been going for the past few years, it's not good for the patients, and it's not been good for the people who work within the NHS. Burnout,
What's
stress, go.
your view about it's what it's tricky, isn't it? So I completely agree with you that the politicians generally take a very almost like sort of very myopic view, which is you can't criticize the NHS, or it's difficult to criticize it, and it's you can't talk about things in a particular way at a political level or a public level without fear of basically being ostracized or cancelled effectively by like the media and the electorate. So how do you think those type of things should be? But presumably, sorry, I just talked over my own self there.
Sorry.
But at a GP level, because obviously within your world there are lots of different committees and groups and associations and things like that. Do you find yourself a lone voice howling into the void, or
No.
are you not, are you your representative of
I
a
would
large group?
say so, especially the younger group of GPs that are coming up as well. We are sick of working in a system whereby we can't serve our patients, we can't deliver the care that we've been trained to deliver because of the underfunding and the resources, under resourcing. And the politicians aren't having those very honest cross-party discussions about this. They stifle that kind of stuff. We are left with other avenues that we have to go down, like tech, for instance. Tech for me is a way in which we can somehow meet the demand and somehow make the care better and deliver it in different ways. So I think it needs to be a kind of a multifaceted approach to solving this crisis, because this crisis isn't actually just in the UK. Across the
No,
world,
it's everywhere.
the demand for healthcare has not been met with the capacity. And I think
And
tech kind of.
is that why is that? I mean, fundamentally, because it is systemic in so many different places, is it just as there aren't enough doctors and nurses and staff, or is it people are getting sicker and sicker and sicker, or is it sort of chronic underfunding of the infrastructure, or kind of everything all at
I
once?
think it's everything all at once, and also, we are victims of our own success. We've helped people live longer lives. They're going to get sick, they're going to die of something. So they're going to get older and sicker, and therefore we're going to have healthcare delivering that. And that's the issue here. And that's why it's such a big thing across the world. But I have to emphasize as well that it's not the user's fault, it's not the patient's fault. When you need healthcare, most people are very, very reasonable still about the way they use healthcare. But I think we also need to do something about, the very small but growing minority who are perhaps
Sorry, go
taking
on.
advantage of it being free.
What classifies for you as sort of a more unreasonable behavior? Gives
I mean, I've
you
got to be careful what I say, but patients who take no responsibility for their own health, these are real examples that I will use. Someone's had a headache for 3 hours, and they're not going to go to the pharmacy. They're demanding, "No, I want to see a doctor." That kind of stuff. I've paid my taxes. I pay your wages. I
Do you
deserve this
hear
healthcare.
do you hear stuff like that?
Oh
Like
yes,
actual do people say that to you?
And the problem is we can't go public about it. We
No.
can go public generically, but you still got to maintain that confidentiality with
It
patients.
is weird, isn't it, that anything that's given away for free loses its value.
Totally, totally. Yeah. How do we put the value back into healthcare? How do we make people appreciate it?
It's
And
very hard.
we've also got you have the regular occurrence of people who put value on how many prescriptions they've got at home. Of medication, you go out to their home sometimes, and they've got cupboards full of medication that they're not taking, but they're hoarding it, and I don't know what they're doing with it because they think that they've got some kind of value from their taxpayer.
Quid pro quo kind of concept.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really difficult, right? I think the thing that I've learned, having worked obviously in our lane within PocDoc, so certainly
Yeah.
not trying to be an expert across the whole system, is
Yeah.
that it's sometimes very overwhelming to know where to start to
Yeah.
solve things.
Yeah.
And it often seems at like a political level easier to just sort of say, we've decided that we're going to give £2 billion to an AI fund. And, if you're an AI startup that wants to work in health, you can apply for this funding. And that's there you go, as opposed to really trying to get into like the nuts and bolts
Yeah.
of certain things.
I think I agree. I think we've kind of given up on the should never give up, but those kind of debates. We did used to campaign for those, past 20 years. I'm kind of more concentrating on tech solutions now because I think that in the current political climate, there's no politician in the UK, at least, that's going to have those honest discussions and debates.
Yeah, and I just wonder, like, I mean, again, that it's such a complex system. Like, I
Yeah.
wonder if anyone really understands the entire, if anyone has an overview of the whole thing, right? It's just so complex now.
Yeah, it is really, and so to find someone who actually understands all the intricacies of general practice these days, there's no corporate memory, and all these people just kind of move on.
Right, there's no corporate, because each GP is effectively its own,
Yeah,
sorry, each surgery is its own entity, right? Is that
yeah,
correct?
yeah. It is, but there are people, the good people in boards like the NHS and ICB, who are going to be moved on soon, and only they can appreciate right now how the whole thing is stuck together. Bit worrying, really.
Yeah, I think so. I guess, yeah, it's really interesting to try and figure out. So how let's take a step back again. When you started being a GP back in, you said 29 years ago, 1990 something, is that
So
right?
I became a partner here in 2000.
2000. Okay.
Yeah.
So were you already on this kind of tech bandwagon slightly, or did you get there later?
We're always early adopters at everything. And if we saw a solution and we saw a problem, we saw a solution, we kind of went for it and we kind of shrugged off the naysayers. For instance, we started doing our own echoes and ultrasounds. We bought a set up an operating theatre when we could, in the days of practice-based commissioning, long time
Wow.
ago. So those are the kind of things that we always used to do because we saw problems with patient care. And why think just a hospital can do that? We can do it, and we can do it at two-thirds the price, much, much faster,
Yeah.
with high quality. So those are the kind of things that kind of appeal to us.
And do you still do that type of thing,
We do,
or
yeah.
right, okay.
We've
So
still got
that proved to be successful.
our scan service has been going since 2008.
Wow.
Yep.
Wow. And why do you think that not more people, or do you, again, I don't know how many surgeries do that or don't do that, but do you see that as being the direction of travel, or are you still a bit of an exception?
So, because the political landscape changes constantly, and what was a good idea then, the next lot come along and they completely try to rearrange everything and it's a total upheaval again. People haven't got the appetite for that because it's you're gonna instigate this change and it might not last. We could have stopped doing our services a long time ago, but we've kind of kept fighting for them to stay on because things do change in the way things are commissioned and all the rest of it.
And keep to fighting getting them funded, or the funding, or accessing the funding streams that make them worthwhile. Because I think that's another thing that people don't understand. We can get into this after the break. And maybe this like goes into the value perception, right? It's like actually real. I remember when we started PocDoc, and I really started to understand the how a GP surgery operates in a financial sense. And it really blew my mind, actually, because I think people think that it's just like, oh, they will look at how many patients you've got and they bung you some cash and like off you go. It's extraordinarily complex, really. And as you say, it changes all the time. There's a new GP contract that's just been published that changes all kinds of different incentives. So why don't we dig into that a little bit? And then I really want to come back around to this, to the patient record. Because I know that you are a huge, what's the word, vocal proponent of sort of opening up that patient record system and advancing it beyond where it currently is. And I think that there's a huge amount of that we can go into that listeners may not be aware of. Although we did have Mo from Patients Know Best on a couple of months ago, who kind of gave us a bit of a overview of the entire patient record system. So we will have to stop for our first commercial break. But we will be right back with my guest on this week's show, Dr. Ammar Ahmed, who is one of the leading GPs in the UK and GP partner at the Wilmslow Health Centre, one of the most technologically advanced GP surgeries in the country in Cheshire. We will be right back.
Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
If optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one super supplement brand, help you achieve that in the most convenient and comprehensive way possible. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, sleep, emotional balance, and more. Benefit from the power, purity, and positivity of our award-winning powder sachets or our therapeutic capsule range. Use code RADIO15 at reviveactive.com and save 15% off today. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my fabulous guest this week, Dr. Ammar Ahmed, who is a GP in the Wilmslow Health Centre in Cheshire and a leading voice in the adoption of health tech into our NHS primary care system, primary care being kind of what most people think of as the GP surgery sort of network. So Ammar, before the break, we were talking about a few different things and kicking them around. One of the things I'd like to kind of pick up on is this concept of a patient record. So I think everyone sort of understands what that means, what the words mean. I don't think many people understand like the real kind of meaning of that in the system,
Yeah.
and the importance of it, and the structure and the infrastructure and all of the sort of stuff that hangs around it. So maybe you could give us a bit of a quick,
Yeah.
viewpoint on that, and why you feel so passionately about the clinical system that surrounds it.
Yeah, so we were talking about primary care before and it being the front door of the NHS. Well, at the centre of primary care is the electronic patient record, the EPR. Everything that a GP does, or even some of the clinical team, the admin team, the non the supportive secretaries, all of that, they all cannot do a thing without the EPR. Everything is in there. So from time to time, and increasingly more frequently over the past few years, these EPRs crash. They go down, they go slow, and that has an enormous impact on primary care organizations, especially given that there are only two main suppliers of systems in the UK. So if one of them goes down, that's over half of all your GP surgeries are actually snookered.
So just to back up a second, right? Because again, this is one of the reasons I wanted you on the show. So when I discovered this, when we started PocDoc, I couldn't believe it. But there are, as it currently stands, if in effect, half of all GP surgeries use one provider, and broadly speaking, half use another. And there are some others in it, but basically, 20 something years, there's only ever been two providers. Is that correct?
25, 25.
25, 25 years. Only two providers, right?
And that is, for me, a disaster because, as we all know, in any sector in life, if you allow a oligopoly to develop, competition goes down, quality goes down, and prices go up. We were in a situation where, I do love all tech companies, all of them. They've served us really, really well. But when it comes to, I had a problem with my EPR where if I put in chest pain as a code, it crashed and it would take me about 3 or 4 minutes to get back onto it. So you found that anyone in our practice, there were no read codes for those years for chest pain. I don't know what the statisticians made of it,
So
but
there was a huge gap in your record because every time you, oh my
we
goodness.
had to use other euphemisms. I mean, because we just couldn't get it fixed because the provider wouldn't fix it for us, and we put so many tickets out for support. But as everyone knows, on some of these providers, the support isn't forthcoming.
And do you think that that's part of their model, in effect, or whether is it just they've been so overwhelmed by all of these? Is it kind of malicious, or is it just they're just
I
overwhelmed?
think they're overwhelmed. I think they're doing their best. I think their intentions are really, really good. But I just think that they're unable to cope. And actually, their contracts haven't been enforced. In any other sector, if I had a contract with someone to provide a mission-critical piece of service, if that service went down, I'd get some compensation for it, wouldn't I?
Yeah, that's
And that
right. You
would,
would.
yeah, and that would
You would.
incentivize them to fix the damn thing. But we've not had any of that, even though we don't commission them directly. But I can't,
So
I
do
might be
they?
wrong. Go
So
on.
let's break this down. So basically, you, as I understand it, but do correct me, there's two providers, and in an NHS region, those providers effectively bid to be the provider for GP surgeries in that region, and then the surgeries get to pick, or is it a bit different?
It's a little bit more nuanced than that. I think historically you could choose your own computer system as GP. That was written into our contracts, especially the 2004 contract. So you could change, but you only had a choice of two. And the other providers have all gone slowly out of business. The system is commissioned then by the by now it would be the ICB or NHS England, but by higher organisations. So though you can choose the actual the mechanics of commissioning and enforcing contracts is out of our hands.
And it's interesting because there are lots of downstream implications to the scaling and adoption of other technologies and this has been a thorn in the side of the NHS for a really long time because, and jump in here, but just to set the scene, lots and lots and lots of health technology businesses require some kind of access to the patient record for them to do what they do.
The APIs.
The APIs, or they need to be able to either put information into the record or read the record to be able to do something with it.
Yeah.
And that's an issue, isn't it?
It is because a lot of the other systems are built on kind of non-standard architecture. Some of them have got their own proprietary APIs.
Mm.
They don't really conform to what's actually been mandated in the NHS for a long time, you know, conforming to global standards of interoperability and communication, FHIR APIs, mesh, all of that. I mean, I'll give you a specific example of how it should work.
Yeah.
We've got, we order tests from the lab.
Yeah.
And we've got various patients who are on certain medications that require routine monitoring.
Yeah.
And what we should have is a system whereby our computer system automates the recall of those people for blood test monitoring. It writes the blood forms.
I suspect that most people listening would assume that that is already happening.
No.
That's so common sense.
It's beginning to happen with certain plugins, but it should be natively built into our EPRs, and it's not been. The move towards modern architecture and better technology will mean, the reason we're doing all of this is that you'll be able to do some really transformative stuff in primary care.
Yeah.
For instance, DMARD monitoring, you'll be able to automate the whole thing.
I don't know what that means. What does that
DMARD?
Mean?
So those are kind of drugs that really need to be monitored very, very carefully because they can cause problems with certain systems in your body if they're not monitored. So you have to really closely monitor the blood tests.
Right. And also it opens up. So one of the things that was published probably not far off when the new government came in, the Labour government, it looked like it was a bit of a, I don't know whether it was official, but it did look like a 1-2 punch from Wes Streeting and then the Blair Institute around electronic patient records and AI and how this can all work together to unlock this sort of future vision of predictive healthcare. And I'm a buyer of that. Like, I'm a buyer of that macro vision.
Yes.
But you, at the moment, the access to those records is kind of controlled by these two companies to a greater or lesser extent.
Absolutely. I mean, for instance, you know, we've got standards for the community services to see our notes, or for hospitals to communicate with us. They should be using mesh, but it has to go through another provider of document services, and we couldn't get them to switch on the mesh to come into the new system. That's the kind of stuff we're kind of locked into, this old legacy architecture. There might not be an incentive. I'm not suggesting that this is the case, but you know, those companies, those legacy companies, need to be incentivized to actually cooperate and open up the architecture so that everyone gets full functionality and access to all the information that is required in a modern general practice.
Do you feel like they are clinging on to try and get that incentive, or are they? Because I, in full disclosure, I don't know anyone, and I've spoken to anyone at those two providers.
But
do they feel like they are continuing to be at the forefront of this, or they're a bit terrified, like the record labels making CDs when you know the Spotify's of the world were coming along?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of both, actually. I mean, far be it from me to accuse them of acting a protectionist way.
No, of course not.
But you know, there has been slowness on part of some to actually allow new entrants into the market with cooperation. But things are moving now. I think people in government are actually catching wind of this and are actually saying, actually, play ball.
Yeah, you have to. You can't. I mean, even things like we're going off down a bit of a rabbit hole. So, you know, apologies for those of you that this is not your bag, but, you know, it's a health tech show. So the government the NHS introduced this thing called GP Connect.
Yeah.
Right, which was designed to be a way to have a sort of industry standard API that then would integrate with the patient record that did not require you to go cap in hand to one of these two companies.
Yeah.
Beg, borrow, and steal to get yourself integrated into one of these two companies.
Yeah.
And that's what PocDoc is doing, as well as a number of other things. But that's one of the routes, because in effect, for the first time, it allows community screening, workplace screening to take place, and for those records to get matched up with the patient record in real time. So it would be a real big deal. But even NHS England, which has set that thing up and done an amazing job, it still requires approval from EMIS, and it still requires an element of cooperation from those two entities for even that session to work.
Yeah. And I think that's it's a testament to the way these things were commissioned in the first place. There wasn't any oversight and thinking about how your data is going to be locked into these systems in a few years' time.
And it is weird, isn't it? Because it kind of my head gets turned around because it's weirdly philosophical at some point, isn't it? It gets a bit existential around what is the record and who does own it? What is that?
Exactly. But I think we can be clear on that. You know, we've got to put the patient at the center of this. And I've been all for patients taking control of the EPR. And I think the modern platforms will really allow them to do that.
And you actually, you moved away from one of the two platforms.
Yeah,
did you not?
We did.
Yes. And so how has that been? You can talk about it to whatever extent you would like. There's no commercial restrictions, but I'm leaving the floor open.
I've been very public about it. So, we went live last Monday.
Right.
And we've not looked back. Yes, there have been teething problems. But actually, we are zooming along on a modern platformed, multi-cloud, multi-web-based architectured EPR. And there's one login. It zips along. And we're really happy with it. We're going to work with the supplier to perfect it. And there's a conveyor belt of lots of other practices waiting in the wings who've got their go-live dates going all the way to Christmas now. So it's an exciting time.
What's the name of the company?
So our particular API is supplied by Medicus, which is a company that was on the NHS program, which is encouraging new market entrants.
Cool.
Into the NHS EPR market. It's great.
That's great.
And they've been working on it for about 5 years. And then we've been working to do all the governance and all the due diligence for the past 18 months and try to work with all the stakeholders to try to go work up to our go live date, which was last Monday.
I think that's another thing, again, which I think it would be helpful if people could realize that one thing that you just said there, which then probably just went by the wayside for a lot of people. They've been working on this system for 5 years.
Yep.
Right? So they've managed to or needed to secure sufficient funding to develop a highly complex clinical system to an unbelievable, it's actually a class 1 medical device, which I found out as I was researching the show, to fund this company for 5 years, all those developers, all those engineers, and so on and so forth. So that valley of death before they can generate revenue is massive. And so if you want more competition in the space, there has to be a really honest discussion around funding and incentives and things like that.
I totally agree with you. I think that there are a number of startups and tech companies who you ask them 2 or 3 years later, would you have done this had you known what you know now? And most of them say, no, I would not go into primary care health tech because of the way things are commissioned and the monopolies and the way that they're not supported. You burn through money until there is even a glimpse of making some of the money back.
Yeah, it's very, I mean, look, I think being a startup in any industry is tough, right? I mean, if you look at businesses that focus on the consumer market, that's unbelievably brutal. I mean, whichever way you go, whether it's B2B or B2C or B2B2C or which way you go, it's tough out there. The thing I think that strikes me most, particularly around primary care, is the very closed nature of it in the UK. So it's very hard to get a foothold in there because it's not an open dynamic marketplace. This is me looking from the outside in. And the other thing is the level of risk is extremely high. You're dealing with the highest level of extremely sensitive data potentially, or you are effectively the layer that determines whether people get an appointment or not, or you're the infrastructure that means that the primary care, the center, the GP surgery can continue to operate at 300 patients a day. I mean, that's fraught with risk everywhere.
No, totally, and more needs to be done to have schemes like the one that Medicus was involved in. There was a lot of companies involved in that, where the NHS actually nurtures these providers and provides them with support.
Did it really?
Make
What's
sure
that called?
the TIF framework, the Technology and Innovation Framework.
That's cool. And so was that specifically focused on trying to increase diversity in these clinical systems?
But in this particular instance, yes. And as part of the process, we interviewed about eight companies who were part of
Oh,
it.
cool.
Some
I
of them
didn't
have
know that.
fallen out now, aren't there anymore.
Yeah.
But we just went with the one that really provided what we wanted to provide to our patients. And
I've got one technical question and then we're going to go to the break. But you mentioned right at the beginning of this second segment that sometimes your previous system, sorry, you would get like a spinning wheel of death and things couldn't happen and it would crash. What happens like on the ground? Because you're moving at like 100 miles an hour every single day. You've got 7 minutes per patient. What actually happens when the thing freezes? What
I
do you do
can't
as a
tell you
clinician?
how totally frustrating it is. And it is a significant source of stress to already burnt out GPs. You're in the middle of something really, really critical. The patient might be with you. You might be doing an admin task, and that's it. You're completely snookered. You can't move on. You can't do anything because all your information is behind that spinning wheel of death. And it's happening increasingly frequently. One provider chose to do an essential update yesterday, Monday, at lunchtime. And again, we
Whoa.
have these WhatsApp groups and it's firing like mad. Everyone's going down one by one across the country. And the
Wow.
loss of productivity is huge. I don't think it's ever been measured, but that
Who
is it's unacceptable.
pushes a significant update on a Monday lunchtime? Why don't you do it overnight?
I honestly don't know. I mean, these are the kind of things that we're stuck with if we don't if
So you've got a patient in front of you. Yeah, my producer's waving madly at me, but I will do this and then because I'm really interested. So you're in the middle of the appointment and you're trying to put in whatever you're trying to put in, the thing's down. Do you then have to make a note to do it later or pass it off to someone to do it later? That creates a whole nother workflow.
Totally, yeah. And on the days that you've been down for a whole day, that has happened twice now, you've had to take paper records.
And then pass them off to somebody to then put them in later or
No,
something.
you'll have to do it yourself, or there has to be a way of doing it. The
Wow.
second, it was happening too frequently, so we actually used some of the ambient scribes
Oh, nice.
to actually record the consultations better, and then
Wow.
we could just cut and paste into. So there's ways around it, but it's just totally unnecessary.
That's crazy. Right. We are going to be back with the last part of today's show where we're going to talk about the funding that sits behind, like, the mechanics, the economics of a GP surgery. So that I think it's like, it'd be really interesting for everyone to understand. It certainly blew my mind when I found out about it. So we'll be back in 2 minutes with the last part of today's show with the wonderful Dr. Amar Ahmed, leading GP in the UK. We will be right back.
The station that makes you feel good.
Is this the year you're going to sort out your health goals? Never heard of frequency medicine, but willing to give it a try? Curious to discover there is a way to click your way to optimal health? At BioHealthScan, we found a way for you to recover your lost good health faster than conventional methods, in a safe and pain-free way. Join in with the rest of us and try our 21-day challenge for optimal health. Do it yourself. Save ourselves today. Find your way to biohealth-scan.com/21-day-challenge. Or, for a whopping 20% discount, click on the BioHealthScan 21-Day Challenge DIY SOS banner on the UK Health Radio homepage now. BioHealthScan, paving the way to manage your health a better way.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Dec, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine.
Love and laugh.
Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better.
Kiss me quick.
Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
Strawberries and cream.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to the last part of this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest this week, Dr. Amar Ahmed. So, Amar, contrary to what potentially sometimes gets thrown around in the Daily Mail and the Daily Express and other papers, potentially, naming their names, GPs aren't exactly like, you know, buying like mega yachts and cruising around Miami. So how has that historically come together? Because I think there is a little bit of a lack of understanding about how complex and multifaceted and difficult the funding landscape is to navigate.
Sure, sure. So I think the first thing to get very clear is that we are independent contractors to the NHS and we hold unlimited liability. If I get my business wrong, I basically lose my house. That's how, you know, we're trying to change that in the new contract. But right now, if we don't get our staff paid, if we don't spend the funding properly, we make up the difference from our own pockets and, you know, it could be disastrous for us. So we're the only part of the NHS that isn't allowed to run a deficit. So I would say that we're probably the most efficient part of the NHS because we're spending money, you know, for our own money, in essence. If we don't spend this money right, we don't get to take any home.
Yeah.
We only get paid if there's anything left over from paying our staff, running all the patient services, and any surplus, that's what we get to call our wage.
Exactly. And you can't say no to anyone either.
No, totally.
You are open. You have minimum opening hours. You have, right? Yeah. You have to be open a certain number of days, a certain number of hours, like the new accept everybody.
Totally. And we can't, like some secondary care organizations, just say, no, enough is enough. We can't take any more. You can't do that. You have to run some kind of waiting list if you can. But actually, most GPs are actually overwhelmed.
Right. And you bear, obviously, personal clinical risk.
Like yes.
If you or, you know, God forbid, anyone in your team makes the wrong decision or prescribes the wrong thing, that's all on you guys, right?
It is. You've got clinical indemnity insurance and you've got specific bits of insurance for other things like data and all the rest of it. But there are things that, you know, there are examples around the country of whereby GPs have actually lost their houses because they didn't have a particular cover in place.
Well, and also patient data loss, effectively unlimited.
Yes.
I mean, the Information Commissioner's Office can pretty much do what they want, in effect, if it's serious enough.
Exactly, yeah. And so, again, you're left with unlimited risk across clinical and non-clinical domains.
So, and part of the funding is basically on a per cap, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's a lot that isn't, and that's where I'm kind of really interested in, because that is unbelievably complex, and it'd be great to get a bit of an oversight into how that, like, it must be an art form to try and stitch all of these things together.
It's really, really tough. And actually, more recently, we're trying to look at AI plugins to our financial packages just to give us a forecast, because it's that complicated. When you get people who are from the NHS looking at how NHS finances are received, you know, they are amazed. How can you run a business like that? Yeah. So you're right. You've got your core GMS contract. And for that, you get a capitation fee for each patient on your list. That is weighted. So it's using something called the Cahill formula, which was set up by Professor Cahill, who himself said his formula should not be used in this way in 2004.
Did he really say that?
Absolutely. Oh, good. Here we are 21 years later, still using it. So that weights your list. So, you know, say you've got 17,000 real patients. They will plug that into a formula, which based on number of kids you've got, number of elderly, all of that, right. And it will weight that list so you only get paid for, you know, a few thousand less. So that's your capitation bit.
And that's designed to sort of say, well, you know, in theory, it's like, okay, if you've got like lots of 20 to 30 year olds, you're probably not seeing them that much, maybe. But if you've got lots of 70 year olds, you're probably seeing them quite a lot. So we'll kind of even this out.
Yeah, that's the well-intentioned aim, but it doesn't work like that at all. There's almost universal acceptance now that it's had its day.
Okay.
So that's the core funding. Then you've got an element that was again introduced in 2004, which is QOF, the Quality and Outcomes Framework. Mm-hmm. And that's basically setting some key performance indicators to every GP, you know, number of diabetics, so you've got the blood sugars down to a certain limit, number of blood pressures you've got under a certain limit. And that also provides quite a significant part of your funding.
But how many measures are on QOF? It's like 100 different
things. Yeah, it's out of control. And I think, again, people have recognized that it is out of control, especially when you haven't really got the IT infrastructure to really keep an eye on it very efficiently.
So it's a bit like saying, the way when I started to learn about this, it was a bit like saying, right, you've almost got 200 different income streams or 200 different products in effect that all from which you derive relatively small payments at a surgery level. Because it might be a few quid per patient per year, and you need to work out how to aggregate all of that to then work out how much money to invest in providing the service.
Yeah,
and you sort of need to be able to do that in real time while also running the surgery. It's just it seems just incredibly complicated.
It's incredibly complicated and incredibly difficult to do, and everyone's feeling it. And you know,
do you get any support, or is it just like? It's just like, here it is, you figure it out.
Absolutely. You can get, there are specialist firms that you can hire to come and do some of the work for you, but it just doesn't make financial sense.
Right.
So, yeah, I think everyone is agreed now that, you know, it generates such an administrative burden that it actually distracts you from patient care.
Because the other thing I think is worth being clear on, and maybe I'm wrong, but I think you also have to report back to the healthcare system according to each QOF measure. It's not like you, so you have to be able to say, right, I've delivered on these 200 things, these is my results. So you have to have that reporting framework in place as well.
You do, dynamically. Absolutely. And there are reporting softwares that can do that for you. Hopefully the new EPRs will do it much better.
Yeah, that would be cool, right? It should be automated out of the EPR.
Totally. You know, the whole recall system should be totally automated. Instead, you've got tiers and tiers of staff whose sole job it is to make sure that you've got the recall in place and that people are attending and chasing them up. It is a huge admin burden. But hopefully there'll be something better to replace it. I'm a firm believer, though, that what you should be doing in any healthcare system is trusting the professionals a bit more and not measuring too much. You know, if I measure my patient's hemoglobin too often, I make them anemic. And I think that's what's gone on with the constant measuring from Whitehall and NHS England.
When did that start and why did it start? Like, presumably it was well-intentioned.
Mostly in 2004. That's when QOF was introduced. And it comes to this this ethos of saying the taxpayer must get value for money, and you can show value for money for absolutely everything. But what it doesn't take into account is the more you keep on measuring, the more time and resources is taken away from actual patient care.
Well, and also health has gotten worse. Now, I'm not saying that's causative, of course, but it's certainly sort of correlated. So you could argue, well, if you took it away, it would get worse. I mean, don't know about that.
No, I would say that before QOF came in, we were doing amazing jobs. You know, and I think the government was taken aback by just how advanced we were in recall. What we had in those days was the ability to innovate and to actually tailor our interventions to our populations. Mm-hmm. This is one size fits all. A lot of the stuff that we see being imposed upon us was kind of developed in East End London, which is fine for that area, but what works in East End London may not work in Cheshire or
Can
Liverpool.
Can you give an example
Manchester.
Of something like that, just for the, what do you mean?
Oh, I think one of the things that's really doing the rounds these days is social prescribing.
Okay.
You know, and social prescribers work really well in very deprived populations, but we've had no use for them at all. And yet you've had this obligation to hire, use money to hire a social prescriber in every PCN. And, you know,
it's an obligation. It's like it's obligated.
An actual obligation. If you want ours funding, you have to have a social prescriber.
Wow. That surely needs a bit more thought, right?
It does. But it's all to do with people saying, oh, this works amazingly well in East London. And it does work well for them. And they've innovated and they've done an incredible job. But then you've got these policymakers trying to transplant that idea across the country, and it just doesn't work.
What's funny about that is that it's well known that it's unbelievably difficult to actually get adoption nationwide of innovation.
Yeah.
But in some instances, they mandate it. It is very confusing.
Yeah, it is. And I think it just supports the idea of giving local health economies and local health areas more autonomy to innovate and trust them to do the right thing.
Yeah.
Don't always measure them. Don't always say, oh, you've got to spend the money like this and micromanage it, because that's a recipe for disaster. It just demoralizes everyone and actually represents very poor value for money for the taxpayer.
Yeah, it also, you know, what gets measured gets done, right? So if you're going to be measured on these things, you're going to do them whether or not you actually kind of need to or not.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So we're in the last 2 minutes of the show. Amar, why don't you paint us a picture in your vision of what you would like to see the primary care space look like in 5 years, if you could wave a magic wand, like what do you go to sleep at night dreaming of?
Well, currently it's all about EPRs, and currently I would love to see our EPR being used, it's not ours, but the one that we've adopted, being used to do really transformative stuff for our patients. You know, we've been looking at AI in so many aspects of the way we run our organization, from AI scribes to AI financial forecasting to AI augmented diagnostics. You know, the other day I did an echocardiogram without any training using a handheld device and got someone's ejection fraction in 3 minutes. So I'm, you know, hoping for an era whereby we've got all the tech lined up on a firm foundation that we can do some amazing stuff for our patients. And that will be good for the taxpayer, it'll be good for the policymakers, and ultimately it'll be good for our colleagues and the profession as well.
Brilliant. On that note, that's the end of the show. So Dr. Amar Ahmed, thank you so much for coming on and giving us an unbelievable level of detail around GP surgery in the primary care space. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And thanks to everyone for listening. We'll be back again next week.